Prologue. The only sin is selfishness, so said the good doctor. When she first expressed this opinion, I was young enough initially to be puzzled, and then to be impressed at what I took to be her profundity. It was only later, in my middle age, when she was long gone from us, that I began to suspect that the opposite is just as true. Arguably, there is a sense in which selfishness is the only true virtue, and therefore that, as opposites are given to canceling each other out, selfishness is finally neutral, indeed valueless, outside a supporting moral context. In later years still, my maturity, if you will, or my old age, if you wish, I have with some reluctance again come to respect the doctor's point of view, and to agree with her, tentatively at least, that selfishness is the root of most evil, if not all. Of course, I always knew what she meant, that it is when we put our own interests before those of others that we are most likely to do wrong, and that there is a commonality of guilt whether the crime is that of a child stealing coins from his mother's purse or an emperor ordering genocide. With either act, and all those in between, we say, our gratification matters more to us than whatever distress or anguish may be caused to you and yours by our actions. In other words, that our desire outranks your suffering. My middle years objection was that only by acting on our desires, by attempting to bring about what pleases us because it feels agreeable, are we able to create wealth, comfort, happiness, and what the good doctor would have termed in that vague, generalizing way of hers, progress. Eventually, though, I came to admit to myself that, while my objection might be true, it is insufficiently all-embracing to cancel out the doctor's assertion entirely, and that while it may sometimes be a virtue, selfishness by its nature is more often a sin, or a direct cause of sin. We never like to think of ourselves as being wrong, just misunderstood. We never like to think that we are sinning, merely that we are making hard decisions and acting upon them. Providence is the name of the mystical, divinely inhuman court before which we wish our actions to be judged, and which we hope will agree with us in our estimation both of our own worth and the culpability or otherwise of our behavior. I suspect the good doctor, you see, I judge her too in naming her so, did not believe in Providence. I was never entirely sure what she did believe in, though I was always quite convinced that she believed in something. Perhaps, despite all she said about selfishness, she believed in herself and nothing else. Perhaps she believed in this progress that she talked about, or perhaps in some strange way, as a foreigner, she believed in us, in the people she lived with and cared for, in a way that we did not believe in ourselves. Did she leave us better off or not? I think, undeniably better. Did she do this through selfishness or selflessness? I believe that in the end it does not matter in the least, except as it might have affected her own peace of mind. That was another thing she taught me, that you are what you do. To Providence, or progress, or the future, or before any other sort of judgment apart from our own conscience, what we have done, not what we have thought, is the result we are judged by. So, the following is the collected chronicle of our deeds. One part of my tale is presented as something I can vouch for I was there. As to the other part, I cannot confirm its veracity. I stumbled across its original version by sheer chance, long after the events described in it had taken place. And while I believe it forms an interesting counterpoint to the story in which I was involved, I present it more as an artistic flourish than as a judgment born of intense study and reflection. Nevertheless, I believe the two tales belong together and carry more weight united than they could separately. It was, I think there is no doubt, a crucial time. Geographically, the crux was divided, but after all, much was then. Division was the only order. I have tried in what I have written here not to judge, yet I confess that I hope the reader, a sort of partial providence perhaps, will do just that and not think badly of us. I freely admit that a specific of my motive, especially in amending and adding to my earlier self's chronicle, as well as in refining the language and grammar of my co-teller, is to try to make sure that the reader will not think ill of me, And, of course, that is a selfish desire. Yet still, I would hope that such selfishness might lead to good, for the simple reason that otherwise this chronicle might not exist. Again, the reader must decide whether that would have been the more fortunate outcome or not. Enough. A young and rather earnest man wishes to address us. 1. The Doctor. Master, it was in the evening of the third day of the southern planting season that the questioner's assistant came for the doctor to take her to the hidden chamber where the chief torturer awaited. I was sitting in the living room of the doctor's apartments, using a pestle and mortar to grind some ingredients for one of the doctor's potions. Concentrating on this, it took me a moment or two fully to collect my wits when I heard the loud and aggressive knocking at the door, and I upset a small censer on my way to the door. This was the cause both of the delay in opening the door and any curses which Unur, the questioner's assistant, may have heard. These swear words were not directed at him. Neither was I asleep or even remotely groggy, as I trust my good master will believe, no matter what the fellow Unur, a shifty and unreliable person by all accounts, may say. The doctor was in her study, as was usual at that time in the evening. I entered the doctor's workshop, where she keeps the two great cabinets containing the powders, creams, ointments, draughts, and various instruments that are the stock of her trade, as well as the pair of tables which support a variety of burners, stoves, retorts, and flasks. Occasionally she treats patients in here, too, when it becomes her surgery. While the unpleasant-smelling Unur waited in the living room, wiping his nose on his already filthy sleeve and peering round with the look of one choosing what to steal, I went through the workshop and tapped at the door to the study, which also serves as her bedroom. "Elf?" the doctor asked. "Yes, mistress." "Come in." I heard the quiet thud of a heavy book being closed and smiled to myself. The doctor's study was dark and smelled of the sweet istra flower whose leaves she habitually burned in roof-hung censers. I felt my way through the gloom. Of course, I know the arrangement of the doctor's study intimately, better than she might imagine, thanks to the inspired foresight and judicious cunning of my master. But the doctor is prone to leaving chairs, stools, and shelf steps lying where one might walk, and accordingly I had to feel my way across the room to where a small candle flame indicated her presence, sitting at her desk in front of a heavily curtained window. She sat upright in her chair, stretching her back and rubbing her eyes. The hand-thick, forearm-square bulk of her journal lay on the desk in front of her. The great book was closed and locked, but even in that cave darkness I noticed that the little chain on the hasp was swinging to and fro. A pen stood in the inkwell, whose cap was open. The doctor yawned and adjusted the fine chain round her neck, which holds the key for the journal. My master knows from my many previous reports that I believe the doctor may be writing an account of her experiences here in Haspid to the people of her homeland in Drazen. The doctor obviously wishes to keep her writing secret. However, sometimes she forgets that I am in the room, usually when she has set me the task of tracking down some reference in one of the books in her extravagantly endowed library, and I have been silently doing so for some time. From the little that I have been able to glimpse of her writings on such occasions, I have determined that when she writes in her journal, she does not always use Haspidian or Imperial, though there are passages in both, but sometimes uses an alphabet I have never seen before. I believe my master has thought of taking steps to check with other natives of Drazen regarding whether, in such instances, the doctor writes in Drazeni or not, and to this end I am attempting to commit to memory as much as I can of the doctor's relevant journal writings whenever I can. On this occasion, however, I was unable to gain a view of the pages she had surely been working on. It is still my wish to be able to serve my master better in this regard, and I would respectfully again submit that the temporary removal of her journal would allow a skilled locksmith to open the journal without damaging it, and a better copy of her secret writings to be taken, so allowing the matter to be settled. This could easily be done when the doctor is elsewhere in the palace, or better still, elsewhere in the city, or even when she is taking one of her frequent baths, which tend to be prolonged. It was during one of her baths that I procured for my master one of the doctor's scalpels from her medicine bag, which has now been delivered. I would add that I was careful to do this immediately after a visit to the poor hospital, so that someone there would be suspected. However, I do, of course, bow to my master's superior judgment in this regard. The doctor frowned at me. "You're shaking," she said. And indeed I was, for the sudden appearance of the torturer's assistant had been undeniably unsettling. The doctor glanced past me towards the door to the surgery, which I had left open so that Unur might be able to hear our voices and so perhaps be dissuaded from any mischief he might be contemplating. "Who's that?" she asked. "Who's what, mistress?" I asked, watching her close the cap of the inkwell. "I heard somebody cough." "Oh, that is Unur, the questioner's assistant, mistress. He's come to fetch you." "To go where?" "To the hidden chamber. Master Nolieti has sent for you." She looked at me without speaking for a moment. "The chief torturer," she said evenly, and nodded. "Am I in trouble, elf?" she asked, laying one arm across the thick hide cover of her journal, as if looking to provide or gain protection. "Oh, no," I told her. "You're to bring your bag and medicines." I glanced round at the door to the surgery, edged with light from the living room. A cough came from that direction, a cough that sounded like the sort of cough one makes when one wants to remind somebody that one is waiting impatiently. "I think it's urgent," I whispered. "Do you think Chief Torturer Nolieti has a cold?" the doctor asked, rising from her chair and pulling on her long jacket, which had been hanging on the back of the seat. I helped her on with her black jacket. "No, mistress. I think there is probably somebody being put to the question who is, unwell." "I see," she said, stamping her feet into her boots and then straightening. I was struck again by the doctor's physical presence, as I often am. She is tall for a woman, though not exceptionally so, and while for a female she is broad at the shoulder, I have seen fishwives and net women who look more powerful. No, what seems most singular about her, I think, is her carriage, the way she comports herself. I have been afforded tantalizing half-glimpses of her, after one of her many baths, in a thin shift with the light behind her, stepping in a coil of powdered, scented air from one room to another, her arms raised to secure a towel about her long, damp red hair, and I have watched her during grand court occasions when she has worn a formal gown and danced as lightly and delicately and with as demure an expression as any expensively tutored season maiden. And I freely confess that I have found myself drawn to her in a physical sense, just as any man, youthful or not, might be to a woman of such healthy and generous good looks. Yet at the same time there is something about her deportment which I, and I suspect most other males, find off-putting, and even slightly threatening. A certain immodest forthrightness in her bearing is the cause of this, perhaps, plus the suspicion that while she pays flawless lip service to the facts of life which dictate the accepted and patent preeminence of the male, she does so with a sort of unwarranted humor, producing in us males the unsettlingly contrary feeling that she is indulging us. The doctor leaned over the desk and opened the curtains and the shutters to the mid-eve Sagan glow. In the faint wash of light from the windows, I noticed the small plate of biscuits and cheese at the edge of the doctor's desk, on the far side of the journal. Her old, battered dagger lay also on the plate, its dull edges smeared with grease. She picked up the knife, licked its blade, and then, after smacking her lips as she gave it a final wipe on her kerchief, slipped the dagger into the top of her right boot. "Come on," she said. "Mustn't keep the chief torturer waiting." "Is this really necessary?" the doctor asked, looking at the blindfold held in questioner's assistant Unur's grubby hands. He wore a long butcher's apron of blood-stained hide over his filthy shirt and loose, greasy-looking trousers. The black blindfold had been produced from a long pocket in the leather apron. Unur grinned, displaying a miscellany of diseased, discolored teeth, and dark gaps where teeth ought to have been. The doctor winced. Her own teeth are so even that the first time I saw them, I naturally assumed they were a particularly fine false set. "Rules," Unur said, looking at the doctor's chest. She drew her long jacket closed across her shirt. "You're a foreigner," he told her. The doctor sighed, glancing at me. "A foreigner," I told Unur forcibly, "who holds the king's life in her hands almost every day." "Doesn't matter," the fellow said, shrugging. He sniffed and went to wipe his nose with the blindfold, then looked at the expression on the doctor's face and changed his mind, using his sleeve again instead. "That's the orders. Gotta hurry," he said, glancing at the doors. We were at the entrance to the palace's lower levels. The corridor behind us led off from the little-used passageway beyond the west wing kitchens and the wine cellars. It was quite dark. A narrow, circular light well overhead cast a dusty sheen of slaty light over us and the tall, rusted metal doors, while a couple of candles burned dimly further down the corridor. "Very well," the doctor said. She leaned over a little and made a show of inspecting the blindfold and Unur's hands. "But I'm not wearing that, and you're not tying it." She turned to me and pulled a fresh kerchief from a pocket in her coat. "Here," she said. "But," Unur said, then jumped as a bell clanged somewhere beyond the flaking brown doors. He turned away, stuffing the blindfold into his apron, cursing. I tied the scented kerchief across the doctor's eyes while Unur unlocked the doors. I carried the doctor's bag with one hand and with my other hand led her into the corridor beyond the doors and down the many twisting steps and further doors and passageways to the hidden chamber where Master Nolietti waited. Halfway there, the bell rang again from somewhere ahead of us, and I felt the doctor jump and her hand become damp. I confess my own nerves were not entirely settled. We entered the hidden chamber from a low doorway we each had to stoop under. I placed my hand on the doctor's head to lower her head. Her hair felt sleek and smooth. The place smelled of something sharp and noxious and of burned flesh. My breathing seemed to be quite beyond my control, the odors forcing their way into my nostrils and down into my lungs. The tall, wide space was lit by a motley collection of ancient oil lamps, which threw a sickly blue-green glow over a variety of vats, tubs, tables, and other instruments and containers, some in human shape, none of which I cared to inspect too closely, though all of them attracted my wide-open eyes like suns attract flowers. Additional light came from a tall brazier positioned underneath a hanging cylindrical chimney. The brazier stood by a chair made from hoops of iron, which entirely enclosed a pale, thin, and naked man, who appeared to be unconscious. The entire frame of this chair had been swiveled over on an outer cradle, so that the man appeared caught in the act of performing a forward somersault, resting on his knees in midair, his back parallel with the grid of a broad lightwell grill above. The chief torturer Nolietti stood between this apparatus and a broad workbench covered with various metal bowls, jars, and bottles, and a collection of instruments that might have originated in the workplaces of a mason, a carpenter, a butcher, and a surgeon. Nolietti was shaking his broad, scarred gray head. His rough and sinewy hands were on his hips, and his glare was fastened on the withered form of the encaged man. Below the metal contraption enclosing the unfortunate fellow stood a broad, square tray of stone with a drain hole at one corner. Dark fluid like blood had splattered there. Long white shapes in the darkness might have been teeth. Nolietti turned round when he heard us approach. "About fucking time," he spat, fixing his stare on first me, then the doctor, and then Unur, who I noticed as the doctor stuffed her kerchief back into a pocket in her jacket, was making a show of folding the black blindfold he had been told to use on her. "My fault," the doctor said in a matter-of-fact manner, stepping past Nolietti. She bent down at the man's rear. She grimaced, nose wrinkling, then came to the side of the apparatus, and with one hand on the iron hoops of the frame chair, brought it squeaking and complaining round until the man was in a more conventional sitting position. The fellow looked in a terrible state. His face was gray, his skin was burned in places, and his mouth and jaw had collapsed. Little rivulets of blood had dried under each of his ears. The doctor put her hand through the iron hoops and tried to open one of the man's eyes. He made a terrible, low, groaning sound. There was a sort of sucking, tearing noise, and the man gave a plaintive moan like a kind of distant scream, before settling into a ragged, rhythmic, bubbling noise that might have been breathing. The doctor bent forward to peer into the man's face, and I heard her give a small gasp. Nolietis snorted. "Looking for these?" he asked the doctor, and flourished a small bowl at her. The doctor barely glanced at the bowl, but smiled thinly at the torturer. She rotated the iron chair to its previous position, and went back to look at the caged man's rear. She pulled away some blood-soaked rags and gave another grimace. I thanked the gods that he was pointing away from me, and prayed that whatever the doctor might have to do would not require my assistance. "What seems to be the problem?" the doctor asked Nolietti, who seemed momentarily nonplussed. "Well," the chief torturer said after a pause, "he won't stop bleeding out his arse, will he?" The doctor nodded. "You must have let your pokers get too cold," she said casually, squatting and opening her bag and laying it by the side of the stone drain tray. Nolietti went to the doctor's side and bent down over her. "How it happened isn't any of your fucking business, woman," he said into her ear. "Your business is to get this fucker well enough to be questioned so he can tell us what the king needs to know." "Does the king know?" the doctor asked, looking up, an expression of innocent interest on her face. "Did he order this? Does he even know of the existence of this unfortunate? Or was it Guard Commander Adlaine who thought the kingdom would fall unless this poor devil suffered?" Nolietti stood up. "None of that is your business," he said sullenly. "Just do your job and get out." He bent down again and stuck his mouth by her ear. "And never you mind the king or the guard, Commander. I'm king down here, and I say you'd best attend to your own business and leave me to mine."
"But it is my business," the doctor said evenly, ignoring the threatening bulk of the man poised over her. "If I know what was done to him and how it was done, I might be better able to treat him."
"Oh, I could show you, doctor," the chief torturer said, looking up at his assistant and winking. "And we have special treats we save just for the ladies, don't we, Unor?"
"Well, we haven't time to flirt," the doctor said with a steely smile. "Just tell me what you did to this poor wretch."
Nolietti's eyes narrowed. He stood up and withdrew a poker from the brazier in a cloud of sparks. Its yellow glowing tip was broad, like the blade of a small, flat spade. "Latterly, we did him with this," Nolietti said with a smile, his face lit by the soft yellow-orange glow. The doctor looked at the poker, then at the torturer. She squatted and touched something at the encaged man's rear.
"Was he bleeding badly?" she asked.
"Like a man pissing," the chief torturer said, winking at his assistant again. Unur quickly nodded and laughed.
"Better leave this in, then," the doctor muttered. She rose. "I'm sure it's good you enjoy your job so, chief torturer," she said. "However, I think you've killed this one."
"You're the doctor, you heal him," Nolietti said, stepping back towards her, brandishing the orange-red poker. I do not think he intended to threaten the doctor, but I saw her right hand begin to drop towards the boot where her old dagger was sheathed. She looked up at the torturer, past the glowing metal rod.
"I'll give him something that might revive him, but he may well have given you all he ever will. Don't blame me if he dies."
"Oh, but I will," Nolietti said quietly, thrusting the poker back into the brazier. Cinders splashed to the flagstones. "You make sure he lives, woman. You make sure he's fit to talk, or the king'll hear you couldn't do your job."
"The king will hear anyway, no doubt," the doctor said, smiling at me.
I smiled nervously back.
And Guard Commander Adlaine, too, she added. Perhaps from me. She swung the man in the cage chair back upright and opened a vial in her bag, wiped a wooden spatula around the inside of the vial, and then, opening the bloody mess that was the man's mouth, applied some of the ointment to his gums. He moaned again. The doctor stood watching him for a moment, then stepped to the brazier and put the spatula into it. The wood flamed and spluttered. She looked at her hands, then at Nolieti. "Do you have any water down here? I mean clean water." The chief torturer nodded at Unur, who disappeared into the shadows for a while before bringing a bowl which the doctor washed her hands in. She was wiping them clean on the kerchief which had been her blindfold, when the man in the chair cage gave a terrible screech of agony, shook violently for a few moments, then stiffened suddenly, and finally went limp. The doctor stepped towards him and went to put her hand to his neck, but she was knocked aside by Nolieti, who gave an angry, anguished shout of his own and reached through the iron hoops to place his finger on the pulse point on the neck, which the doctor has taught me is the best place to test the beat of a man's vitality. The chief torturer stood there quivering, while his assistant gazed on with an expression of apprehension and terror. The doctor's look was one of grimly contemptuous amusement. Then Nolieti spun round and stabbed a finger at her. "You!" he hissed at her. "You killed him! You didn't want him to live!" The doctor looked unconcerned and continued drying her hands, though it seemed to me that they were both already dry and shaking. "I am sworn to save life, Chief Torturer, not to take it," she said reasonably. "I leave that to others." "What was in that stuff?" the Chief Torturer said, quickly squatting to wrench open the doctor's bag. He pulled out the open vial she had taken the ointment from and brandished it in her face. "This! What is it?" "A stimulant," she said, and dipped a finger into the vial, displaying a small fold of the soft brown gel on her fingertip so that it glinted in the light of the brazier. "Would you like to try it?" She moved the finger toward Nolieti's mouth. The chief torturer grabbed her hand in one of his and forced the finger back towards her own lips. "Now, you do it. Do what you did to him." The doctor shook her hand free of Nolieti's and calmly put her finger to her mouth, spreading the brown paste along her top gum. "The taste is bittersweet," she said, in the same tone she uses when she is teaching me. "The effects last between 2 and 3 bells, and usually have no side effects, though in a body seriously weakened and in shock, fits are likely and death is a remote possibility." She licked her finger. "Children in particular suffer severe side effects with almost no restorative function, and it is never recommended for them. The gel is made from the berries of a biennial plant which grows on isolated peninsulae on islands in the very north of Drazen. It is quite precious, and more usually applied in a solution, in which form, too, it is most stable and long-lasting. I have used it to treat the king on occasion, and he regards it as one of my more efficacious prescriptions. There is not much left now, and I would have preferred not to waste it on either those who are going to die anyway or on myself, but you did insist. I am sure the king will not mind." "I have to report, Master, that as far as I am aware, the doctor has never used this particular gel, of which she has several jars, on the king, and I am not sure she had ever used it to treat any patient." The doctor closed her mouth, and I could see her wipe her tongue round her top gum. Then she smiled. "Are you sure you won't try some?" Nolieti said nothing for a moment, his broad, dark face moving as though he was chewing on his tongue. "Get this Drazen witch out of here," he said eventually to Unur, and then turned away to stamp on the brazier's foot bellows. The brazier hissed and glowed yellow, showering sparks up into its sooty chimney. Nolieti glanced at the dead man in the cage chair. "Then take this bastard to the acid bath," he barked. We were at the door when the chief torturer, still working the foot bellows with a regular thrusting stroke, called out, "Doctor!" She turned to look at him as Unur opened the door and fished the black blindfold from his apron.
"Yes, chief torturer," she said.
He looked round at us, smiling as he continued to fire the brazier. "You'll be here again, Drazen woman," he said softly to her. His eyes glittered in the yellow brazier light. "And next time you won't be able to walk out." The doctor held his gaze for a good while, until she looked down and shrugged. "Or you will appear in my surgery," she told him, looking up, "and may be assured of my best attention." The chief torturer turned away and spat into the brazier, his foot stamping on the bellows and breathing life into that instrument of death, as we were ushered out of the low door by the assistant Unur. 200 heartbeats later, we were met at the tall iron doors which led into the rest of the palace by a footman of the royal chamber. "It's my back again, Vosil," the king said, turning onto his front on the wide, canopied bed, while the doctor rolled up first her own sleeves and then the king's tunic top and shift. And we were in the principal bedchamber of King Quience's private apartments, deep within the innermost quadrangle of Ephrens, the winter palace of Haspid, capital of Hospitus. This has become such a regular haunt of mine, indeed such a regular place of work, that I confess I am inclined to forget that I am honored indeed to be present. When I stop to consider the matter, though, I think, great gods, I, an orphan of a disgraced family, am in the presence of our beloved king, and regularly and intimately. At such moments, master, I thank you in my soul with all the vigor that is mine to command, for I know that it was only your kindness, wisdom, and compassion that put me in such an exalted position and entrusted me with such an important mission. Be assured that I shall continue to try with all my might to be worthy of that trust and fulfill that task. Wister, the king's chamberlain, had led us into the apartments. "Would that be all, sir?" he asked, bending and hunching over as well as his ample frame would allow. "Yes, that's all for now. Go." The doctor sat on the side of the king's bed and kneaded his shoulders and back with her strong, capable fingers. She had me hold a small jar of rich-smelling unguent, which she dipped her fingers into every now and again, spreading the ointment across the king's broad, hairy back, and working it into his pale gold skin with her fingers and palms. As I sat there, with the doctor's medicine bag open at my side, I noticed that the jar of brown gel which she had used to treat the wretch in the hidden chamber was still lying opened on one of the bag's ingeniously fashioned internal shelves. I went to stick my own finger into the jar. The doctor saw what I was doing and quickly took hold of my hand and pulled it away from the jar, and said quietly, "I wouldn't, Elf, if I were you. Just put the top back on carefully." "What's that, Vosil?" the king asked. "Nothing, sir," the doctor said, replacing her hands on the king's back and leaning forward onto him. "Ouch!" the king said. "Mostly muscular tension," the doctor said softly, flicking her head so that her hair, which had partly fallen across her face, was sent spilling back over her shoulder. "My father never had to suffer so," the king said morosely into his gold-threaded pillow, his voice made deeper by the thickness and weight of fabric and feathers. The doctor smiled quickly at me. "What, sir?" she said. "You mean he never had to suffer my clumsy ministrations?" "No," the king said, groaning. "You know what I mean, Vosil. This back, he never had to suffer this back, or my leg cramps, or my headaches, or my constipation, or any of these aches and pains." He was silent a moment as the doctor pushed and pressed at his skin. "Father never had to suffer anything. He never had a day's illness in his life," the doctor said, in chorus with the king. The king laughed. The doctor smiled at me again. I held the jar of ointment, inexpressibly happy for just that moment, until the king sighed and said, "Ah, such sweet torture, Vosil!" Whereupon the doctor paused in her rocking, kneading motion, and a look of bitterness, even contempt, passed briefly over her face. 2. The Bodyguard. This is the story of the man known as Diwar, who was principal bodyguard to General Erlane, prime protector of the Tassassin Protectorate for the years 1218 to 1221 Imperial. Most of my tale takes place in the Palace of Vorophir in Krog, the ancient capital city of Tassassin, during that fateful year of 1221. I have chosen to tell the story after the fashion of the juridic fabulists, that is, in the form of a closed chronicle, in which, if one is inclined to believe such information of consequence, one has to guess the identity of the person telling the tale. My motive in doing so is to present the reader with a chance to choose whether to believe or disbelieve what I have to say about the events of that time, the broad facts of which are, of course, well known, even notorious throughout the civilized world, purely on the evidence of whether the story rings true for them or not, and without the prejudice which might result from knowing the identity of the narrator, closing the mind of the reader to the truth I wish to present. And it is time the truth was finally told. I have read, I think, all the various accounts of what happened in Tassassin during that momentous time, and the most significant difference between those reports seems to be the degree to which they depart most outrageously from what actually happened. There was one travesty of a version in particular which determined me to tell the true story of the time. It took the form of a play and claimed to tell my own tale, yet its ending could scarcely have been wider of the mark. The reader need only accept that I am who I am for its nonsensicality to be obvious. I say this is Diwar's story, and yet I freely admit that it is not the whole of his story. It is only part, and arguably only a small part, measured solely in years. There was a part before, too, but history allows only the haziest notion of what that earlier past was like. So this is the truth as I experienced it, or as it was told to me by those I trusted. Truth, I have learned, differs for everybody. Just as no two people ever see a rainbow in exactly the same place, and yet both most certainly see it, while the person seemingly standing right underneath it does not see it at all, so truth is a question of where one stands and the direction one is looking in at the time. Of course, the reader may choose to differ from me in this belief and is welcome to do so. Diwar, is that you? The Prime Protector, First General and Grand Edil of the Protectorate of Tassassin, General Erlane, shaded his eyes from the glare of a fan-shaped plaster and gem window above the hall's polished jet floor. It was midday, with Zamis and Sagan both shining brightly in a clear sky outside.
Sir, Diwar said, stepping from the shadows at the edge of the room, where the maps were kept in a great wooden lattice. He bowed to the protector and set a map on the table in front of him.
I think this is the map you might need.
Diwar, a tall, muscular man in early middle age, dark-haired, dark-skinned, and dark-browed, with deep hooded eyes and a watchful, brooding look about him that quite suited his profession, which he once described as assassinating assassins. He seemed both relaxed and yet tensed, like an animal perpetually hunkered back, ready to pounce, yet perfectly capable of remaining in that coiled position for as long as it might take for its prey to come into range and let drop its guard. He was dressed, as ever, in black. His boots, hose, tunic, and short jacket were all as dark as an eclipse night. A narrow, sheathed sword hung from his right hip, a long dagger from his left.
"You fetch maps for my generals now, Diwar?" Erlane asked, amused. The general of generals of Tassassin, the commoner who commanded nobles, was a relatively small man who, by dint of the bustling, busy force of his character, made almost everybody feel that they were no taller than he. His hair was brindled, gray and thinning, but his eyes were bright. People generally called his gaze piercing. He was dressed in the trousers and long jacket he had made the fashion amongst many of his fellow generals and large sections of the Tassassini trading classes.
"When my general sends me away from him, sir, yes," Diwar replied.
"I try to do whatever I can to help, and such actions help prevent me dwelling on the risks my lord might be exposing himself to when he has me leave his side. Diwa tossed the map onto the table, where it unrolled.
The borders, Ladenshin,
Erlane breathed, patting the soft surface of the old map, then looking up at Diwar with a mischievous expression.
My dear Diwar, the greatest danger I expose myself to on such occasions is probably a dose of something unpleasant from some lass newly brought in, or possibly a slap for suggesting something my more demure concubines find excessively rude.
The general grinned, hitching up the belt round his modest potbelly.
Or a scratched back or bitten ear, if I'm lucky, eh?
The general puts us younger men to shame in many ways, Diwar murmured, smoothing out the parchment map. But it is not unknown for assassins to have less respect for the privacy of a great leader's harem than, say, his chief bodyguard.
An assassin prepared to risk the wrath of my dear concubines would almost deserve to succeed,
Erlane said, eyes twinkling as he pulled at his short gray mustache.
Providence knows their affection is rough enough at times.
He reached out and tapped the younger man's elbow with one bunched fist.
Eh?
Indeed, sir. Still, I think the general could...
Ah, the rest of the gang, Erlane said, clapping his hands as the double doors at the far end of the hall opened to admit a number of men, all clad similarly to the general, and a surrounding flock of aides in military uniforms, frock-coated clerks, and assorted other helpers.
Yetamidus,
the protector cried, walking quickly forward to greet the big, rough-faced man leading the group, shaking his hand and clapping his back. He greeted all of the other noble generals by name, then caught sight of his brother.
Ruluin, back from the throne isles, is all well?
He wrapped his arms round the taller, thicker-set man, who smiled slowly as he nodded and said,
Yes, sir.
Then the protector saw his son and bent down to lift him into his arms.
And Latins, my favorite boy, you finished your studies.
Yes, father, the boy said.
He was dressed like a little soldier and flourished a wooden sword.
Good. You can come and help us decide what to do about our rebellious barons and the marches.
Just for a while, brother, Ruluin said.
This is a treat. His tutor needs him back on the bell.
Ample time for Latins to make all the difference to our plans, Erlane said,
sitting the child on the map table. Clerks and scribes scuttled over to the great wooden map lattice on one wall, fighting to be first.
Never mind, the general called after them.
Here's the map, he shouted, as his brother and fellow generals clustered round the great table.
Somebody already,
the general began, looking round the table for Diwar, then shaking his head and returning his attention to the map. Behind him, hidden from the protector by the taller men gathered about him, but never more than a sword length away, his chief bodyguard stood, arms casually crossed, hands resting on the pommels of his most obvious weapons, unnoticed and almost unseen, gaze sweeping the surrounding crowd.
Once there was a great emperor who was much feared throughout what was then all the known world, save for the outer wastelands, which nobody with any sense bothered about, and where only savages lived. The emperor had no equals and no rivals. His own realm covered the better part of the world, and all the kings of all the rest of the world bowed down before him and offered him generous tribute. His power was absolute, and he had come to fear nothing except death, which comes eventually for all men, even emperors. He determined to try and cheat death, too, by building a monumental palace so great, so magnificent, so spellbindingly sumptuous, that death itself, which was believed to come for those of royal birth, in the shape of a great fiery bird visible only to the dying, would be tempted to stay in the great monument and dwell there, and not return to the depths of the sky with the emperor clutched in its talons of flame. Accordingly, the emperor caused a great monumental palace to be built on an island in the center of a great circular lake on the edge of the plains and the ocean,
some way from his capital city. The palace was fashioned in the shape of a mighty conical tower, 100 stories tall. It was filled with every imaginable luxury and treasure the empire and kingdoms could provide, all secured deep within the furthest reaches of the monument, where they would be hidden from the common thief, yet visible to the fiery bird when it came for the emperor. There, too, were placed magical statues of all the emperor's favorites, wives and concubines, all guaranteed by his holiest holy men to come alive when the emperor died and the great bird of fire came to take him. The chief architect of the palace was a man called Munosh, who was renowned throughout the world as the greatest builder there had ever been, and it was his skill and cunning that made the whole great project possible. For this reason, the emperor showered Munosh with riches, favors, and concubines. But Munosh was 10 years younger than the emperor, and as the emperor grew old and the great monument neared completion, he knew that Munosh would outlive him and might speak or be made to speak of how and where the great cache of riches had been placed within the palace once the emperor had died and was living there with the great bird of fire and the magically alive statues. Munosh might even have time to complete a still greater monument for the next king who ascended to the imperial throne and became emperor. With this in mind, the emperor waited until the great mausoleum was all but finished, and then had Munosh lured to the very deepest level of the vast edifice. And while the architect waited in a small chamber deep underground for what he had been promised would be a great surprise, he was walled in by the imperial guards, who closed off all that part of the lowest level. The emperor had his courtiers tell Munosh's family that the architect had been killed when a great block of stone fell on him while he was inspecting the building, and they grieved loudly and terribly. But the emperor had misjudged the cunning and wariness of the architect, who had long suspected something just like this might happen. Accordingly, he had constructed a hidden passage from the lowest cellars of the great monumental palace to the outside. When Munosh realized he had been immured, he uncovered the hidden passage and made his way to the ground above, where he waited until the night and then stole away on one of the workers' boats, gliding across the circular lake. When he returned to his home, his wife, who thought she was a widow, and his children, who thought they were without a father, at first thought he was a ghost and shrank from him in fear. Eventually, he persuaded them that he was alive and that they should accompany him into exile, away from the empire. The whole family made their escape to a distant kingdom, where the king had need of a great builder to oversee the construction of fortifications to keep out the savages of the wastelands, and where everybody either did not know who this great architect was, or pretended not to for the sake of the fortifications and the safety of the kingdom. However, the emperor heard that a great architect was at work in this distant kingdom, and through various rumors and reports came to suspect that this master builder was indeed Munosh. The emperor, who was by now very frail and elderly and near death, ordered the secret opening up of the great mausoleum's lower levels. This was done, and of course Munosh was not there, and the secret passageway was discovered. The emperor ordered the king to send his master builder to the imperial capital. The king at first refused, asking for more time, because the fortifications were not yet ready, and the savages of the wasteland were proving more tenacious and better organized than had been anticipated. But the emperor, still nearer to death now, insisted, and eventually the king gave in and with great reluctance sent the architect Munosh to the capital. The architect's family treated his departure as they had the false news that he had been killed those many years ago. The emperor at this time was so close to dying that he spent almost all his time in the great death-defying palace Munosh had constructed for him, and it was there that Munosh was taken. When the emperor saw Munosh and knew that it was his old chief architect, he cried out, "Munosh! Treacherous Munosh! Why did you desert me and your greatest creation?" "Because you had me walled up within it and left to die, my emperor," Munosh replied. "It was done only to assure the safety of your emperor and to preserve your own good name," the old tyrant told Munosh. You ought to have accepted what was done and let your family mourn you decently and in peace. Instead, you led them into benighted exile and only ensured that now they will have to mourn you a second time. When the emperor said this, Menashe fell to his knees and began to weep and to plead for forgiveness from the emperor. The emperor held out one thin, shaking hand and smiled and said, "But that need not concern you, because I have sent my finest assassins to seek out your wife and your children and your grandchildren, to kill them all before they can learn of your disgrace and death." At this, Menashe, who had concealed a mason's stone chisel beneath his robes, leapt forward and tried to strike the emperor down, aiming the chisel straight at the old man's throat. Instead, Menashe was struck down before his blow could fall by the emperor's chief bodyguard, who never left his master's side. The man who had once been imperial chief architect landed dead at his emperor's feet, head severed by a single terrible blow from the bodyguard's sword. But the chief bodyguard was so full of shame that Menashe had come so close to the emperor with a weapon, and also so appalled at the cruelty which the emperor intended to visit on the innocent family of the architect, which was but the grain that breaks the bridge, for he had witnessed a lifetime's cruelty from the old tyrant, that he killed the emperor and then himself with another two swinging blows from his mighty sword before anybody else could move to stop him. The emperor got his wish then, dying within the great palatial mausoleum he had built. Whether he succeeded in cheating death or not, we cannot know, but it is unlikely, as the empire fell apart very soon after his death, and the vast monument he caused to be constructed at such crippling expense to his empire was looted utterly within the year and fell quickly into disrepair, so that now it is used only as a ready source of dressed stone for the city of Hasped, which was founded a few centuries later on the same island in what is now called Crater Lake in the kingdom of Hasped.
"What a sad tale! But what happened to the family of Menashe?" asked the Lady Parand.
The Lady Parand had once been the first concubine of the Protector. She remained a prized partner of the general's household, and one whom he was still known to visit on occasion. The bodyguard Diwar shrugged. "We don't know," he told her. "The empire fell, the kings fought amongst themselves, the barbarians invaded from all sides, fire fell from the sky, and a dark age resulted that lasted many hundreds of years. Little historical detail survived the fall of the lesser kingdoms."
"But we may hope that the assassins heard their emperor was dead and so did not carry out their mission, may we not? Or that they were caught up in the chaos of the empire's collapse and had to look to their own safety. Would that not be likely?"
Diwa looked into the eyes of the Lady Parand and smiled. "Perfectly possible, my lady."
"Good," she said,
crossing one arm across the other and settling back to lean over the game board again.
"That is what I shall choose to believe, then. Now we can restart our game. It was my move, I believe."
Diwa smiled as he watched Parand put one clenched fist to her mouth. Her gaze, beneath long, fair lashes, flicked this way and that across the game board, coming to rest on pieces for a few moments, then sweeping away again. She wore the long, plain red day gown of the senior ladies of the court, one of the few fashions the Protectorate had inherited from the earlier kingdom, which the Protector and his fellow generals had overthrown in the War of Succession. It was a given within the court that Perrin's seniority was founded more upon the intensity of her earlier service to the Protector Erlane than on her physical age, a reputation, that of most favored concubine to a man who had not yet chosen a wife, she was still fiercely proud of. There was another reason for her promotion to such seniority, and the mark of that was the second badge she wore, the sling, also red, that supported her withered left arm. Parand, anybody in the court would tell you, had given more of herself in the service of her beloved general than any other of his women, sacrificing the use of a limb to protect him from an assassin's blade, and indeed very nearly losing her life altogether. For the same cut that had severed muscles and tendons and broken bone had opened an artery as well, and she had come close to bleeding to death, even as Erlane had been hurried away from the melee by his guards, and the assassin had been overpowered and disarmed. The withered arm was her only blemish, even if it was a terrible one. Otherwise, she was as tall and fair as any fairy-tale princess, and the younger women of the harem, who saw her naked in the baths, inspected her golden brown skin in vain for the more obvious signs of encroaching age. Her face was broad, too broad, she thought, and so framed it carefully in her long blonde hair to make it look slimmer when she did not wear a headdress, and chose headdresses which performed the same function when she was to be seen in public. Her nose was slim and her mouth at first plain, until she smiled, which she often did. Her pupils were gold flecked with blue, and her eyes were large and open and somehow innocent. They could quickly look hurt at insults, and when she was told tales of cruelty and pain, but such expressions were like summer storms, over quickly and immediately replaced by a prevailing temperate brightness. She seemed to take an almost childish delight in life in general, which was never far from being embodied in the sparkle of those eyes, and people who thought they knew about such things said they believed she was the only person in the court whose force of gaze could match that of the protector himself. "There," she said composedly, moving a piece across the board into Diwar's territory and then sitting back. Her good hand massaged the withered one, which lay in the red sling, motionless and unresponding. Diwar thought it looked like the hand of a sickly child. It was so pale and thin, and the skin so nearly translucent. He knew that she still experienced pain from the disabled limb 3 years after the initial injury, and that she did not always realize when her good hand stroked and kneaded the sick one as it did now. He saw this without looking at it, his gaze held by hers as she leaned further back into the couch's cushions, which were as plump, red, and numerous as berries on a winter bush. They sat in the visiting chamber of the outer harem, where on special occasions close relatives of the concubines were sometimes allowed to visit them. Diwar, once again waiting on Erlane while the general spent a while with the harem's most recent young recruits, had for some time been granted the singular dispensation of being allowed to enter the visiting chamber whenever the protector was in the harem. This meant that Diwar was a little closer to Erlane than the general would ideally have preferred his chief bodyguard to be during such interludes, and much further away than Diwar felt comfortable with. Diwar knew the sort of jokes that circulated the court about him. It was said that his dream was to be so close to his master at all times that he could wipe the general's backside in the toilet and his prick in the harem alcove. Another was that he secretly desired to be a woman, so that when the general wanted sex, he need look no further than his faithful bodyguard, and no other bodily contact need be risked. Whether Stike, the harem's chief eunuch, had heard that particular rumor was moot. Certainly he watched the bodyguard with what appeared to be great and professional suspicion. The chief eunuch sat massively in his pulpit at one end of the long chamber, which was lit from above by 3 porcelain light domes. The chamber's walls were entirely covered with thickly pendulous swathes of ornately woven brocade, while further loops and bowls of fabric hung suspended from the roof spaces between the domes, ruffling in the breeze from the ceiling louvers. The chief eunuch Stike was dressed in great folds of white, and his vast waist was girdled with the gold and silver keychains of his office. He occasionally spared a glance for the few other veiled girls who had chosen the visiting chamber for their giggled conversations and petulant games of card and board, but he concentrated on the only man in the room and his game with the damaged concubine, Perrond. Diwar studied the board. "Aha," he said. His emperor piece was threatened, or certainly would be, in another move or two. Perrond gave a dainty snort, and Diwar looked up to see his opponent's good hand held up flat against her mouth, painted fingernails golden against her lips, and an expression of innocence in her wide eyes. "What?" she asked. "You know what," he said, smiling. "You're after my emperor."
"Diwar," she said, tutting, "you mean I'm after your protector."
He said, putting his elbows on his knees and his chin on his bunched fists. Officially, the Emperor was called the Protector Peace now, after the dissolution of the old empire and fall of the last king of Tassassin. New sets of the game of Monarch's Dispute, sold in Tassassin these days, came in boxes which, to those who could read, proclaimed the game they contained to be Leader's Dispute, and held revised pieces. A protector instead of an emperor, generals in place of kings, colonels instead of dukes, and captains where before there had been barons. Many people, either fearful of the new regime or simply wishing to show their allegiance to it, had thrown out their old sets of the game along with their portraits of the king. It seemed that only in the palace of Vorafir itself were people more relaxed. Diwar lost himself studying the position of the pieces for a few moments. Then he heard Perrin make another noise and looked up again to see her shaking her head at him, eyes glittering. Now it was his turn to say, "What?"
"Oh, Diwar," she said, "I have heard people in the court say you are the most cunning person they know in it, and thank Providence that you are so devoted to the general, because if you were a man of independent ambition, they would fear you."
Diwar shrugged. "Really? I suppose I ought to feel flattered, but..."
"And yet you are so easy to play at dispute," Perrin said, laughing.
"Am I?"
"Yes, and for the most obvious reason. You do too much to protect your protector piece. You sacrifice everything to keep it free from threat." She nodded at the board. "Look, you are thinking about blocking my mounted piece with your eastern general, leaving it open to my tower after we've exchanged caravels on the left flank. Well, aren't you?"
Diwar frowned deeply, staring at the board. He felt his face flush. He looked up again at those golden, mocking eyes. "Yes? So I am transparent, is that it?"
"You are predictable," Perrin told him softly. "Your obsession with the Emperor, with the Protector, is a weakness. Lose the Protector, and one of the generals takes its place. You treat it as though its loss would be the end of the game. I was wondering, did you ever play A Kingdom Unjustly Divided before you learned Monarch's Dispute?" she asked. "Do you know of it?" she added, surprised when he looked blank. "In that game, the loss of either king does indeed signify the end of the game."
"I've heard of it," Diwar said defensively, picking up his protector piece and turning it over in his hands. "I confess I haven't played it properly, but..."
Perrin clapped her good hand on her thigh, attracting the frowning stare of the watchful eunuch.
"I knew it," she said, laughing and rocking forward on the couch. "You protect the protector because you can't help it. You know it's not really the game, but it would hurt you to do otherwise because you are so much the bodyguard."
Diwar put the protector piece back down on the board and drew himself up on the small stool he sat upon, uncrossing his legs and adjusting the positions of his sword and his dagger. "It's not that," he said, pausing to study the board again briefly. "It's not that. It's just my style, the way I choose to play the game."
"Oh, Diwar," Perrin said with an unladylike snort. "What nonsense. That is not style, it's fault. If you play like that, it's like fighting with one hand tied behind your back."
She looked down ruefully at the arm in the red sling.
"Or one hand wasted," she added, then held up her good hand to him as he went to protest. "Now just you never mind that. Attend to my point. You cannot stop being a bodyguard, even when playing a silly game to pass the time with an old concubine while your master dallies with a younger one. You must admit it and be proud. Secretly or not, it's equal to me, or I shall be quite thoroughly upset. Now, speak and tell me I'm right."
Diwar sat back, holding both hands out wide in a gesture of defeat. "My lady," he said, "it is just as you say."
Perrin laughed.
"Don't give in so easily. Argue."
"I can't. You're right. I am only glad that you think my obsession might be commendable, but it is just as you say. My job is my life, and I am never off duty. And I never will be until I am dismissed, I fail in my job, or Providence consigns such an eventuality to the distant future. The Protector dies a natural death."
Perrin looked down at the board. In a ripe old age, as you say, she agreed before looking up at him again. And do you still feel you're missing something which might prevent such a natural end?
Diwar looked awkward. He picked up the protector piece again, and, as though addressing it, in a low voice said, His life is in more danger than anybody here seems to think. Certainly it is in more danger than he appears to believe. He looked up at the Lady Parent, a small, hesitant smile on his face. Or am I being too obsessive again?
I don't know, Perrin said, sitting closer and dropping her voice too. Why you seem so sure that people want him dead?
Of course people want him dead, Diwar said. He had the courage to commit regicide, the temerity to create a new way of governing. The kings and dukes who opposed the protector from the start found him a more skilled politician and far better field commander than they'd expected. With great skill and a little luck, he prevailed, and the acclamation of the newly enfranchised in Tassassin has made it difficult for anybody else in the Old Kingdom, or indeed anywhere in the Old Empire, to oppose him directly.
There must be a but or an however about to make its appearance here, Perrin said. I can tell it.
Indeed. But there are those who have greeted Erlane's coming to power with every possible expression of enthusiasm, and who have gone out of their way to support him in most public ways, yet who secretly know that their own existence, or at the very least their own supremacy, is threatened by his continued rule. They are the ones I'm worried about, and they must have made their plans for our protector. The first few attempts at assassination failed, but not by much. And only your bravery stopped the most determined of them, lady, Diwar said.
Perrin looked away, and her good hand went to touch the withered one. Yes, she said. I did tell your predecessor that as I had stepped in to perform his job, he ought to do the decent thing and attempt to fulfill mine one day, but he just laughed.
Diwar smiled. Commander Zespiol tells that story himself still.
Well, perhaps as commander of the palace guard, Zespiol does such a good job keeping would-be assassins away from the palace that none ever achieve the sort of proximity that might call for your services.
Perhaps, but either way they will be back, Diwar said quietly. I almost wish they had been back by now. The absence of conventional assassins makes me all the more convinced there is some very special assassin here, just waiting for the right time to strike.
Perrin looked troubled, even sad, the man thought. But come, Diwa, she said. Is this not too gloomily contrary?
Perhaps there are no attempts on the Protector's life because no one of moment any longer wishes him dead.
Why assume the most depressing explanation? Can you never be, if not relaxed, then content?
Diwa took a deep breath and then released it. He replaced the Protector piece. These are not times when people in my profession can relax.
They say the old days were always better. Do you think so, Diwa?
No, lady, I do not. He gazed into her eyes. I think a lot of nonsense is talked about the old days.
But, Diwa, they were days of legends, days of heroes, Perrin said, her expression indicating she was not being entirely serious. Everything was better. Everybody says so.
Some of us prefer history to legends, lady, Diwar said heavily. And sometimes everybody can be wrong.
Can they?
Indeed. Once everybody thought the world was flat.
Many still do, Perrin said, raising one brow. Few peasants want to think they might fall out of their fields, and a lot of us who know the truth find it hard to accept.
Nevertheless, it is the case, Diwar smiled. It can be proved.
Perrin smiled, too. With sticks in the ground?
And shadows and mathematics?
Perrin gave a quick, sideways nod. It was a mannerism that seemed to acknowledge and dismiss at the same time. What a very certain, if rather dismal, world you seem to live in, Diwar.
It is the same world that everyone inhabits, if they but knew, my lady. It's just that only some of us have our eyes open.
Perrin drew in a breath.
Oh, well, those of us still stumbling around with our eyes tightly shut had best be grateful to people like you, then, I should think.
I'd have thought that you, at least, my lady, would have no need of a sighted guide.
I am just a crippled, ill-educated concubine, Diwa. A poor orphan who might have met a terrible fate if I had not caught the eye of the protector.
She made her withered arm move by flexing her left shoulder towards him.
Sadly, I later caught a blow as well as a glance, but I am as glad of one as the other.
She paused, and Diwar drew a breath to speak, but then she nodded down at the board and said,
"Are you going to move or not?"
Diwar sighed and gestured at the board. "Is there any point, if I am so deficient an adversary?"
"You must play, and play to win even if you know you will probably lose," Perrin told him. "Otherwise you should not have agreed to begin the game in the first place."
"You changed the nature of the game when you informed me of my weakness."
"Ah, no, the game was always the same, Diwa," Perrin said, sitting suddenly forward, her eyes seeming to flash as she added with a degree of relish. "I merely opened your eyes to it."
Diwa laughed. "Indeed you did, my lady." He sat forward and went to move his protector piece, then sat back again and with a despairing gesture said, "No, I concede, my lady. You have won." There was some commotion amongst the group of concubines nearest to the doors which led into the rest of the harem. In his high pulpit, the chief eunuch Stike wobbled to his feet and bowed to the small figure bustling into the long chamber. "Diwar," the protector Erlane called, hauling his jacket on over his shoulders as he strode towards them. "And Perrind, my dear, my darling." Perrin stood suddenly, and Diwar watched her face come alive again, the eyes widening, her expression softening, and her face blossoming into the most dazzling smile as Erlane approached. Diwar stood too, the faintest of hurt expressions vanishing from his face, to be replaced by a relieved smile and a look of professional seriousness.
3. The Doctor. "Master, you ask to know most particularly of any sorties which the doctor made outside the palace of Efferns. What I am about to relate took place the afternoon following our summons to the hidden chamber and our encounter with the chief torturer, Nolieti. A storm raged above the city, making of the sky a darkly boiling mass. Fissures of lightning split that gloom with an eye-blinding brightness, as though they were the concentrated blues of the everyday sky, fighting to prize the blackness of the clouds apart and shine upon the ground again, however briefly. The westerly waters of Crater Lake leapt against the city's ancient harbor walls and surged amongst the deserted outer docks. It made even the ships within the sheltered inner quays roll and shift uneasily, their hulls compressing the cane fenders to make them creak and crack in protest, while their tall masts swung across the black sky like a forest of disputing metronomes. The wind whistled through the streets of the city as we made our way out of the blister gate and headed across Market Square towards the Warren. An empty stall had been blown over in the square, and its sack roof flapped and tore in the gusts, clapping against the cobblestones like a trapped wrestler slapping the ground as he begs for mercy. The rain came in blustery torrents, stinging and cold. The doctor handed me her heavy medicine bag as she wrapped and buttoned her cloak more tightly about her. I still believe that this, along with her jacket and coat, should be purple, as she is a physician. However, when she had first arrived 2 years earlier, the doctors of the city had let it be known that they would take a dim view of her pretending to this badge of their rank, and the doctor herself had seemed indifferent in the matter. And so, as a rule, she wore mostly dark and black clothes, though sometimes, in a certain light, in some of the garments she paid to have made by one of the court tailors, I thought one could catch just a hint of purple in the weave. The wretch who had brought us out into this awfulness limped on ahead, glancing back at us every now and again as if to make sure we were still there. How I wished we were not,
If ever there was a day for curling up by a roaring fire with a cup of mulled wine and a heroic romance, this was it. Come to that, a hard bench, a tepid cup of leaf, and one of the doctor's recommended medical texts would have seemed like bliss to me compared to this.
Filthy weather, eh, Elf?
Yes, mistress.
They do say the weather has been much more violent since the fall of the Empire, which is either Providence punishing those who helped overthrow it, or an imperial ghost exacting revenge from beyond the grave. The cur who had lured us into this absurd mission was a hobble-legged child from the barrows. The palace guards hadn't even let her into the outer bastion. It had been sheer bad luck that some fool of a servant, bringing the guards a note of instruction, had overheard the brat's preposterous pleadings and taken sympathy on her, coming to find the doctor in her workshop, mortar and pestling her pungently arcane ingredients with my help, and report that her services were requested by some bastard from the slums. I could not believe it when she agreed. Couldn't she hear the storm groaning round the lanterns in the roof above? Hadn't she noticed I'd had to light all our lamps in the room? Was she deaf to the gurgle of drain water in the walls? We were on our way to see some destitute breed who were distantly related to the servants of the Mithelis, the chiefs of the trader clan the doctor had worked for when she had first come to Haspid. The king's personal physician was about to pay a call in a storm, not on anyone noble, likely to be ennobled or indeed even respectable, but on a family of slack-witted, all-runt ne'er-do-wells, a tribe of contagiously fleed happen-ills, so fundamentally useless they were not even servants, but merely the hangers-on of servants, itinerant leeches on the body of the city and the land. Coinless and hopeless, to be short about it, and even the doctor might have had the sense to refuse but for the fact that she had, bizarrely, heard of this sickly urchin.
"She has a voice from another world," she'd told me as she'd swirled on her cloak, as though this was all the explanation required.
"Please hurry, mistress," wailed the whelp who'd come to summon us. Her accent was thick and her voice made irksome by her disease-dark, snaggle teeth.
"Don't tell the doctor what to do, you worthless piece of shit," I told her, trying to be helpful. The lame brute ducked and hobbled away in front, across the glistening cobbles of the square.
"Elf, kindly keep a civil tongue in your head," the doctor told me, grabbing her medicine bag back from me.
"But mistress," I protested. At least, though, the doctor had waited until our limping guide was out of earshot before chastising me. She screwed up her eyes against the lashing rain and raised her voice above the howl of the wind. "Do you think we can get a cab?" I laughed, then turned the offending noise into a cough. I made a show of looking around as we approached the lower edge of the square, where the lame child had disappeared down a narrow street. I could just make out a few scavenging people scattered along the eastern side of the square, flapping back and forth in their rags as they collected the half-rotted leaves and rain-sodden husks which had been blown there from the center of the square, where the vegetable market had been. Not another soul to be seen. Certainly not a cabbie, rickshaw puller, or chair carrier. They had more sense than to be out in weather like this.
"I think not, mistress," I said.
"Oh, dear," the doctor said, and seemed to hesitate.
For one wonderful moment I thought she might see sense and return us both back to the warmth and comfort of her apartments, but it was not to be.
"Oh, well," she said, holding the top of her cloak closed at her neck, settling her hat more firmly on her gathered-up hair, and putting her head down to hurry onwards. "Never mind. Come on, Elf." Cold water was creeping down my neck.
"Coming, mistress."
The day had passed reasonably well until then. The doctor had bathed, spent more time writing in her journal. Then we had visited the spice market and nearby bazaars, while the storm was still just a dark brew on the western horizon. She had met with some merchants and other doctors at the house of a banker to talk about starting a school for doctors. I was consigned to the kitchen with the servants, and so heard nothing of consequence and little of sense. Then we walked smartly back up to the palace,
while the sky clouded over and the first few rain squalls swept in over from the outer docks. I fondly and quite mistakenly congratulated myself for escaping back to the comfort and warmth of the palace before the storm set in. A note on the door to the doctor's rooms informed us that the king desired to see her, and so it was off towards his private apartments as soon as we'd put down our bags full of spices, berries, roots, and earths. A servant intercepted us in the long corridor with news that the king had been wounded in a practiced duel, and, hearts in our mouths, we made quickly for the game halls.
"Sire, a leech! We have the finest, the rare emperor leech from Brotikin."
"Nonsense! A burned glass veining is what is required, followed by an emetic."
"A simple letting will suffice. Your Majesty, if I may..."
"No! Get away from me, you withering purple rogues! Away and become bankers, the lot of you! Admit what you really love! Where's Vosil?" "Vosil!" the king cried up the broad stairs as he started up them, left hand clutched round his right upper arm. We were just starting down. The king had been injured in a dueling round, and it seemed as if every other doctor of repute in the city must have been in the dueling chamber that day, for they were clustered round the king and the two men at his side like purple-coated chasers round a beast at bay. Their own masters followed at their heels, holding dueling swords and half-masks, with one large, gray-faced individual isolated near the rear, presumably being the one who'd cut the king. Guard Commander Adlaine was to one side of the king, Duke Whalen on the other. Adlaine, I will record only for posterity, is a man the nobility and grace of whose features and carriage are matched only by our good king, though the guard commander's appearance is swarthy where King Quience's is fair, a faithful, loyal shadow ever at the side of our splendid ruler. But what monarch could wish for a more glorious shadow? Duke Whalen is a short, stooped man with leathery skin and small, deeply recessed eyes which are slightly crossed.
"Sir, are you sure you won't let my physician tend to that wound?" Whalen said in his high, grating voice, while Adlaine shooed away a couple of the harrying doctors.
"Look," the Duke cried, "it's dripping, the royal blood. Oh, my word, physician, physician! Really, my lord, this doctor fellow is quite the best. Let me just..."
"No," the king bellowed. "I want Vosil. Where is she?" "The lady would appear to have more pressing engagements," Adlaine said, not unreasonably. "Lucky it's just a scratch, eh, my lord?" Then he looked up the steps to see the doctor and myself descending. His expression became a smile. "Though," the king roared, head down as he bounded up the curve of steps, briefly leaving both Whalen and Adlaine behind.
"Here, sir," the doctor said, stepping down to meet him.
"Vosil, where in the name of all the skies of hell have you been?"
"I..."
"Never mind that. Let's to my chambers. You," and the king addressed me, "see if you can hold off this pack of blood-sucking scavengers. Here's my dueling sword." The king handed me his own sword. "You have full permission to use it on anyone who looks remotely like a physician. Doctor?"
"After you, sir."
"Yes, of course after me, Vosil. I am the king, dammit." It has always struck me how well our glorious king resembles the portraits one sees displayed of him in paintings and in the profiles which grace our coins. I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to study those magnificent features that mid-zamis in the king's private apartments while the doctor treated the dueling wound and the king stood, clad in a long gown with one sleeve rolled up, in silhouette against the luminous expanse of an ancient plaster window, face raised and jaw set as the doctor worked at his outheld arm. End of side one.